We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. I'm excited to share something new from Muse. If you're like the rest of us that struggle with getting a good night's sleep, you'll want to check out the new digital sleeping pill. It's an intuitive sleep guide. It's part of the next generation of Muse S, and it responds to your brain activity to help quiet your busy mind and guide you into a more restful sleep. It's a responsive kind of sleep experience that's designed to lull you to sleep and help you fall back to sleep if you wake up during the night. Check it out at choosemuse.com and use discount code LAUNCH15 to give it a try. Now, on to Arielle.
Hello and welcome to another Untangle. I have two wonderful guests for you today, not one but two, Nate and Kaylee Klemp. They're an amazing couple that together co-authored the new book, The 80-80 Marriage, a new model for a happier, stronger marriage. Both of them are also incredible in their own right. Nate is actually one of the founders of a company that's partnered with Mindful.org. He has a PhD from Princeton University, and is the author of Start Here, Master the Lifelong Habit of Well-Being. So he's deeply steeped in mindfulness. Kaylee is an amazing expert on small group dynamics and leadership development. Her books include The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership, The Drama-Free Office, and let's just say if you can make a drama-free office, you can probably make a drama-free marriage. And she created The 13 Guidelines for Effective Teams. So between the two of them, they're here today to talk about the amazing power of bringing mindfulness into your relationship and how to have a happier one. Welcome, Nate and Kaylee.
Thanks so much for having us.
We are so happy to be here.
It is my joy and pleasure. Let's start by talking, first of all, about what it's like to work together as a couple. You guys wrote a book together. You co-create. Tell me about it.
It's a funny thing because I think initially we had a semi-conscious agreement to never work together. We had created separate worlds, as you had described, each pursuing our own areas. And then it was really this project around marriage that clearly we're doing as a joint project in our life, and recognized that initially Nate was going to write this book as a solo author, which we thought was going to be really interesting, but thought that it would actually be more powerful to do together. So now working together, living together, parenting together, being married. There is a lot of together. And I think that makes all of the tools that we talk about even more interesting.
So how do you handle and manage a lot of together? Because sometimes a lot of together can be too much.
Yeah, absolutely. On top of the book and working together for the first time, we had the pandemic, which was like a new challenge of being together and working together. And I think that for us, there were a couple of main things we needed to do. One was we needed to recognize the importance of space, where back in the old days, Kaylee was an executive coach traveling for 2 to 3 days each week. We sort of had built-in time apart, so we were excited to see each other at the end of those times. And our life obviously changed, and we were together all the time. So there was this importance on finding just a little bit more physical space. So times where we're just alone, going on a walk, something like that. But then we talk a lot about mental space or headspace, which I know you talk a lot about as well. Just this idea of creating some space in the mind, because part of what I'm experiencing anyway in this pandemic condition is that there's this compression of mental space. There's so much distraction. There's noises happening around us in the house constantly. So being able to cultivate more mental or headspace has also been a huge part of staying sane and together.
How do you work through and navigate the challenges that come up? Even the challenge of writing a book, you want to do it one way or another way. The challenge of filling the dishwasher, you want to do it one way, he wants to do it another way. How do you manage those differences?
I'm laughing actually really hard because the dishwasher happens to be one area where like hilarious amounts of tension will actually show up.
It's where the power struggle happens in this house.
In my relationship too, I can't tell you how many arguments we have about the dishwasher.
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. I was on another call this morning and that was the thing there too, where somebody was laughing. They were saying, I load the dishwasher. He takes all the dishes out and reloads it his own way. We giggled. But I think that this is where the connection and the transition and the overlap really between marriage and mindfulness is so powerful, is that when there are conflicts, I think that there are a couple of things that show up. One, having some space just to recognize our own reactivity and to be aware of, as we talk about in the 80-80 marriage, the tendency to come from a perspective of resentment or comparison or competition, and have that thought that says, this is not rocket science. How can it be so hard to load the dishwasher? But to catch that thought and instead of acting on it, to really instead, we talk a lot about shift to a mindset of radical generosity.
Can you talk a little bit more about that shift? What people tend to notice the tension as and how to make that shift?
It's interesting. In mindfulness and in marriage, we're dealing with all these cognitive biases and systematic ways in which we're thinking in a slightly diluted way. So in mindfulness, we talk a lot about how we often see impermanence as permanent, right? We see the crick in our neck or the thought or the emotion as something that's going to last forever, but it doesn't. It's just a cognitive bias. And when it comes to marriage, the primary bias that we identified, we interviewed about 100 people for this project, is this bias in how we assess what is or isn't fair. So if we take the dishwasher as an example, many people will start making all sorts of judgments about fairness when they see the dishwasher has not been unloaded and they're the one who did it the last 3 times. And what's really interesting is we learned from the research on relationships and marriage that there's sort of 2 fundamental problems with the way we think about fairness and comparison in marriage. So the first is availability bias, which is basically just a fancy way of saying that I have a tendency to systematically underestimate what Kaylee does because all of her wonderful contributions are just unavailable to me. I see everything I do every time I go out and shovel the snow or whatever, but everything that happens in her world is more difficult for me to see. And then there's also a second bias, which is we have a tendency as individuals to overestimate what we do. So in other words, we're constantly overestimating the amount of childcare we've done, the amount of housework we've done. And as a result, we have these conflicts quite a bit over what is or isn't fair. And we're coming to these conflicts with just basically diluted information that's irreconcilable.
So what's the methodology for reconciling that? So I feel like I've loaded the dishwasher and taken care of my kid far more than you have. You're so lazy. I'm so great. This isn't fair. So how do you shift that in your mind? What allows you to unlock it and bring in that sense of generosity and fairness?
There are really, I think, two significant parts, and mindfulness underlies all of it. So first is just even knowing that we're operating this world of cognitive bias helps shift it a little bit to begin with. So as a, for instance, I'm sitting there and I'm folding the basket of laundry and I'm thinking to myself, like, what am I doing? How come he's not doing this? That even just knowing, wait a second, I'm comparing this load of laundry to the null set of laundry that he's folding at this exact moment in time. And we go, that's crazy. It's, if you think about sports metaphors, it's like trying to compare, well, how many touchdowns did that cricket player make? And like, there are no touchdowns in cricket. That doesn't make any sense. And yet somehow in marriage, we make all these comparisons that don't make any sense. So first is just the recognition of the biases so that we can go time out self. And then the second is the intentional shift to generosity. So one is recognizing it's not even a reasonable comparison to be making, and two is to intentionally shift. So instead of trying to make it fair, instead we try to be generous. We try to do 80% rather than just our 50 that's the halfway point, recognizing that, one, we're totally aware the math makes no sense, that there is no such thing as 160% whole. And yet by striving for that, by doing things from that perspective of, I'm trying to be generous, I'm striving to contribute, that helps us do it from a space that's actually more generous to begin with.
Hence the name of your book, The 80-80.
Indeed.
Exactly.
So it's no longer about 50-50. I do half the work, you do half the work. If I do a bit more than half, then I'm losing out on things that I could have been doing in my life and you're lazy. Now it's 80-80. Now it's we're both contributing as much as we can in order to be generous to each other in the household.
Exactly. Part of why we wrote this book is we think that most modern couples are grappling with this fundamental question of being together, which is, how can you be equals and in love? And for us, and I think for most couples, the way we naturally tend to go toward equality or move toward equality is through this incredibly clunky technology of fairness, of just like comparing what we do against what our partner does. And we think that if we get really good at those comparisons, and if we berate our spouse enough with the fact that there's inequality, somehow we're going to magically arrive at 50-50. What we experienced in our own life and when interviewing a number of couples is that usually the reverse is actually true. So in our marriage, when we got married at 26, that was 15 years ago, Kaylee was like a fully functional adult. She had a job at Deloitte Consulting and was becoming an executive coach. I, on the other hand, was this grad student bohemian guy who made $15,000 a year and cleaned my apartment twice a year. So we fell into this pattern of Kaylee as the over-contributor, me as the under-contributor. And the goal was to make everything fair. But the more Kaylee would push toward fairness, the more I would withdraw, the less I would do. So it actually created greater inequality. And so a big part of the motivation for this book was trying to figure out if we really want to be equals and we want to be in love and not hate each other, which I think is what most married couples want, there's got to be a better technology. There's got to be a better way of getting there, both in terms of our mindset, how we think, but also in like how we structure our lives together.
And I think that you really named it, which is what comprises the mindset of 80-80 is this idea of you are striving to do 80%. You're striving to do more than your fair share. And you do that really with three ingredients. The first is about contribution. So these are the things that we do. This might be loading the dishwasher 3 times in a row or cooking a meal because your partner is still on a call. But it could also be something like leaving a sticky note that says, I love you on their computer screen. That it's really looking for the ways that you can give small gifts in your relationship that kind of feel above and beyond, not because now I've got a favor in my pocket, but rather out of that spirit of generosity.
Yeah, and we talk a lot about appreciation, which we think of as like the way you see your partner in marriage. There's this kind of default tendency of the mind to fixate on the negative. But neuroscientists call it the negativity bias, right? We talk about this a lot in mindfulness. It extends to marriage where we tend to see all the things that our partner's doing wrong or the ways they're not doing enough. And appreciation is really about like flipping that mindset and putting on a new pair of glasses in marriage where you're actually like looking for the things your partner does right. And when you see that, just giving them a simple thank you can be game changing.
So those are beautiful techniques. But what would you say to someone who already feels like they're doing the 80%? And now they hear this and they're just like, so you're asking me to do more? Yes, I'll do it generously towards my husband, but what if I still perceive him as lazy? I still feel like he's not giving the 80% himself. How do you solve that tension?
There's two pieces there. One is about the idea of, wait, isn't it just crazy radically unfair to be asking the person who already feels like they're doing more to then do more again? Like, hey, if you're the person who's listening to this and you're thinking radical generosity, that sounds great. Wait a second, I already do more. I'm going to take the lead on this too. Yes, it's crazy. And in some ways, it is unfair. What we found is that really a lot of the time, people end up doing the same things, but it actually feels really different for that person. That in some ways, if you're doing the same activity, it's a cortisol bath if you're doing it from a perspective of resentment, whereas doing the same thing, making the meal or helping your kid get online for at-home school, or today we have a snow day, so trying to figure out the Zoom link to get online because there's no school. All of that, if you're doing it from resentment, how come you're not helping? It feels worse than if you're doing it from generosity as a gift to you both. But the second piece, I think there's a real importance around if you feel like you're already striving to do 80%, if you already feel like you're leading with radical generosity and you're not being met, making a request of your partner is really important. That we talk about this practice called reveal and request, that sometimes we'll think that our partner will just notice and that they can read our mind and therefore they will do something different. And most of the time when communication by mind reading occurs, we're disappointed with the results. And so being able to say, hey, I'm trying out this new paradigm. Hey, I'm working to contribute in our relationship and I would love for you to read this, or I would love for you to try on this same practice. Making that request can also help both of you land in that more generous headspace.
Well, and I would just add one thing to that, which is the way that you make that ask is really important. So in other words, like the underlying motivation and mindset of that ask is huge and determines how it's going to land. So if Kaylee says, you never do your fair share, it's not fair, you're a slacker in this marriage and you need to do more, my natural tendency is going to be to move away and do less, right? It's going to just land with a thud. If, on the other hand, she comes to me and makes that ask from this spirit of radical generosity and kindness, all of a sudden I can hear her. So what we found in our own life and in a lot of couples is sometimes these asks are being made. They're just being made in a way where the other partner can't hear it.
Can we hear that being asked? Can you model it for people who are sitting here being like, how on earth would I say that and not get the bad response?
Yeah, why don't you do both, the good and the bad ask?
Yeah, definitely. What do you want me to ask you about?
Unloading the dishwasher more.
All right. If I want Nate to never unload the dishwasher again, then the way that it would sound is, are you serious? I'm unloading the dishwasher for the 4th time this week. It is your turn. If I, however, would like him to help me in the future, it might sound like, hey, babe, I think this is the fourth time we've run the dishwasher this week. Can you believe how often we run this in the pandemic? Would you mind helping me? And if he goes, I can't, babe. I'm so busy with work. I just have to run out and do this. I might say, hey, I notice it really hurts my feelings when I feel like I'm the only one who's doing work around the house. Would you be willing to help me at a different time? So it's coming back with what's going on inside. It hurts my feelings when I feel like I'm the only one who's doing it. And is there another way? Is there another time that we could do this? Again, if what you get met with is like, ugh, absolutely not, then there's a different conversation that says, hey, I'm having a really hard time with this conversation and feeling like you're not receptive to hearing what needs I have. What's a different way that I can ask that you can hear me? And so you can actually start to almost go meta. What's a way that I can ask these questions such that you can hear me? Even allows your partner to start to engage with facilitating that listening.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Okay, so you just did a whole bunch of amazing ninja skills in there. Can we break them down even further? Because this is a situation we've all been in 100 times.
Yeah,
for sure.
One of the main techniques that I heard in there was sharing how you felt and how his actions applied to you. So rather than casting blame on you did this, it is, hey, when this happens, it makes me feel. You talk a little bit about that one?
In some ways, this is really just the essence of this simplified form of clearing an issue that we write about in the book, which we call reveal and request. So there's 2 key parts to it. The first is what you were pointing to, which is the reveal. And as you mentioned, it's a really different strategy than what we generally do, where if I'm upset about Kaylee, often I'll criticize her or there'll be some sort of blame involved. And the reveal is just expressing my inarguable emotional truth. So when you came late to dinner, I felt frustrated. And you could even get more into the mindfulness form that, like, I felt this kind of like heat in my chest. You could describe the sensations that arise, because those are impossible to argue with, right? Like, I'm feeling this sensation in my chest, feels like frustration. There's really not an argument to be had about that. So that's part one. But then the second piece is it can be very helpful often to attach a tangible request there, right? To give your partner a little bit of feedback and guidance, again, from a spirit of kindness. So in the case of Kaylee coming late to dinner, my ask is that you text me next time if you're going to be late, or just make dinner a priority, whatever that ask might be. But it helps give Kaylee guidance on how she can come back into integrity with me.
I think there is a really important piece that you've pointed to there, which is around attribution. That if I believe that my experience is your fault, then it makes it much more difficult to reveal and make that request from a clean place. Whereas if what I recognize is you are doing whatever you're doing in life, like you're showing up just in the kitchen or unloading the dishwasher or arriving or not at dinner, and I'm having a whole world of experiences inside, and I'm willing to be with those experiences and take responsibility for them, it really changes the flavor of how those get revealed.
That's beautiful. Now, on the side of the person who is listening, the person who's listening now has 2 choices: to either hear you generously and openly and have the moment of sensation in their body of sadness because they made you feel that way, and then be like, yes, I'll do that thing that you requested, I'm so sorry. Or the likely more common reaction, judging from my experience as a human being, having had this reaction many times, which is shame that they've just hurt their partner, fear, and the desire to defend. Because it's like, no, it can't possibly be right that I hurt you. Therefore, clearly the thing I did was fine because I don't want to see that I hurt you and I'm okay and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that on the side of the listener?
It's so true. I mean, it's half the skill is how you reveal, half the skill is how you listen to the reveal. And you're right that there's this natural human tendency to get defensive, to feel shame, to feel anger, to lash out. So one thing that I think we found to be quite helpful is in these moments to point out or bracket this from ordinary conversation by saying something really simple. So if Kaylee just did something that really pissed me off, I might say, hey, I have a reveal for you. That's an indication that like we are exiting normal conversation where we can have a debate about what the best policy is for sustainability or whatever it is. And we're now entering this new plane of conversation where ritualizing what's about to happen. So that I think is really helpful just to say, I have a reveal so that both people can get in the right mindset for this to happen.
And ideally, exactly as Nate is saying, that signals to your partner, okay, I'm in a transition where I can consciously listen with curiosity. If, however, our humanness takes over and that defensive reaction or the righteousness comes up instead, I actually think sometimes revealing that is also a really helpful facilitative gesture to be able to say, I'm so defensive right now. Let me take a breath and come back to you. Or to be able to say, I notice that I really want to make my way the right way. And just being able to be in the dialogue where both people can say what's going on inside then allows you to meet in the place where you can say, this is kind of about the dishwasher, but it's mostly about we want to show up for each other in a spirit of care. And I want to know you more. And when you reveal to me something that could be small but has symbolic meaning about feeling taken for granted or feeling like you're over contributing or like what you care about the other person doesn't care about. If you're able to stay in that connective energy of I care about you, I love you, I want to know what's going on inside, you can keep growing beyond whatever that content is. This is about the laundry or the dishwasher or Zoom, and instead stay with more connection even beyond the initial defensiveness.
That's beautiful, really beautiful. So hearing this, what's going on in my mind is if you have a partner, it would be really helpful to have them listen to this podcast or read the book with you so that you're both on the same page and you both have the same language and dialogue.
Yeah, totally. Well, and one other thing that I just think is important to point out here is if you can get into this practice of reveal and request and you can do it mindfully, something really amazing happens, which is these moments that normally push you away from each other or pull you apart, the moments where there's a misunderstanding or somebody's feelings are hurt, they go from being the things that pull you apart to being the things that bring you back together and that actually establish connection. So if I'm really upset at Kaylee and we are successful in just revealing our truth in that moment, I reveal to her that I'm upset. She may reveal to me that there's something going on her end. We've taken this moment that would ordinarily be a rupture in our connection, and we've used it to get closer. That's just an amazing thing if you think about it. We're basically taking, I think of Suzuki, the Zen master who talks about the weeds in the mind and how the weeds are actually the really interesting and important things that allow us to grow. We're taking like the weeds in our relationship and we're using those weeds as the catalyst for growth and connection.
I also love what you were saying. It's been really fun that we've gotten notes from some people who are like, I'm reading 80-80 Marriage as a book club with my spouse. And what's so fun is that there are conversations that they're having exactly as you just indicated, where ideally you could bring those up regardless of whether your partner's read it or not, but it's so much easier when you already start with the same foundation to say, hey, so in that podcast, when they were talking about whatever it might be, what do you think? Or how does that apply to us? Or for us, I don't think it's the dishwasher. I think it's whether or not it's important to take the Kleenex out of the backseat of the car, whatever it might be.
So it's really, really powerful, and really powerful when you have a couple who is both able to be present and listen and want to make the change. I know from the people that I've been speaking to that some people are just so far gone at this moment and the stress that they're under and the boilerplate, the boiler room that they're in a relationship and a household, that defenses are so high that this level of dialogue might seem like it's leagues away. If you're the one in the relationship that's read the book, the one in the relationship that's doing the work, and then you tell your partner this and they respond with defensiveness, how do you bring them in?
If you're the one in the relationship who wants to continue to work, wants to continue to grow, you're recognizing that your partner perhaps is more stuck or more resistant or more defensive, there's a couple different ways. One is you can really sometimes only change your own experience of being in the relationship. So this is where it sounds unfair, and in some respects it is, but how you experience your own contribution and whether or not it feels like it's coming from resentment or generosity is one way. Two is the revealing that we talked about. If that's not available, where you're saying like, hey, defenses are just too high. In ADHD marriage, we talk about the difference between sinkhole problems and pothole problems. And pothole problems are the ones that dialogue helps you really address. Sometimes, though, couples have found themselves in a sinkhole where trying to have the conversation can actually start to make it worse, right? It's trying to leave quicksand where the more movement you do, it actually entrenches you more deeply. And that's a space where we would say it's really valuable to find someone outside the relationship who can really help you. And so that might be a rabbi or a pastor, or a coach, a therapist, if you've got a mindfulness teacher or a guide, someone where you can bring some of what's happening and have somebody who's not in the system with you help facilitate a dialogue if it feels like it's too intense for the two of you to do solo.
That's great. And one of the things that I've noticed in my own relationship is that my mindfulness practice has been key. Hands up, I'm the person who was the defensive one years ago. And my defenses would make it so hard to hear what I was doing as wrong, or make it feel like it was so hard to believe that I could possibly be hurting my partner in this way. We're talking about the dishwasher, similarly benign things, and that he would feel disrespected because I didn't empty the dishwasher when he did. And it would be like, how could you possibly feel that way? And it was through my mindfulness practice that I was able to A, recognize how it was possible, and B, really be able to slow down and watch my own reactions and watch the pathway of defensiveness, the pathway of pushing away, the pathway of hurt and shame that I could have hurt someone that way, the pathway of veiling my own actions. And I could see it start to unravel, this thing that would happen in an instant, this muddle of reactivity, all of a sudden started to slow down, and I could unravel each of the pieces of it and recognize how unwarranted they were, even though they felt so incredibly natural and always ended up with the sense of the thing I did was fine because I had these 12 other things I needed to do while you were emptying the dishwasher or whatever the scenario was. And really allowed me to have deep, deep compassion for the experience that he was in rather than a sense of shut down or push away or shut off.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful description of your practice. And it's so amazing to hear how that changed for you, changed your experience of marriage. I would say it was the exact same for me. I've been practicing mindfulness now for quite some time. And I would say the way I would describe the practice is it's just consistently given me a little bit more space. I remember I had one early mindfulness teacher who said, like, for every 10 years of mindfulness, you get an extra half second of space between stimulus and response. And I think that feeling of space is really important. And it's made me think that when it comes to all these different systems for relationships and books on marriage, so we have our book, The 80-80 Marriage, there are all sorts of other great books. The tools that you get out of a book like that are second order tools that are only useful and available to you if you're using a first order technology like mindfulness or technique like mindfulness that allows you to see what's happening, interrupt your habitual patterns, and do something more skillful and different. Because without mindfulness, I think a lot of what we've been talking about, radical generosity, shifting towards shared success, reveal and request, it's off the table in a sense, because our hardwired habits are just so strong that those are always going to win the day unless we're able to slow it down, as you said, and see what's happening inside and experience some of those sensations and shift out of that ordinary habit stream.
Can you talk a little bit about your own personal mindfulness practices and how you see it played out in your relationship?
I find that lots of different things count in terms of centering and grounding. So for me, it's a lot about walking, and particularly walking outside in nature, that there is something literally grounding about the experience of being on a trail and leaving some of the things that are happening in my mind out on that trail. And the other thing that I think happens, and you were describing this earlier really beautifully, that facilitates some observation and some self-observation, where I can look back at a scene where perhaps there was conflict or a misunderstanding and get curious about it from a different perspective. And so being able to literally walk some things off, but also to ask the question, how else could I see this? Or how could the opposite experience be true? And practicing, I love the work of Byron Katie, to be able to look at something and say, huh, how could the opposite be as true or truer? Or how can I experience what is happening and love what is rather than arguing with reality, has been really significant. And the way that that shows up for me in our relationship is, one, being able to see the exchanges between us from that different perspective, but also being able, exactly as Nate was saying, to allow some space where when something happens, I can go, huh, I wonder how much of this is what actually happened and how much of this is just between my ears. And when I recognize that the very vast majority is just happening in my own self-storytelling, it allows me to show up with him with a lot more love and compassion.
Yeah. And then for me, I guess yoga was really my way into mindfulness. That's how this whole thing started for me. I got into a very serious yoga practice, but then I got really interested in a lot of different forms of mindfulness practice. So focused attention practice, training my ability to sustain attention on the breath. In the last 4 or 5 years, I would say, that's shifted to a combination of focused attention and some open awareness Dzogchen practice I found to be very useful. And what that looks like on a day-to-day basis is I'll wake up, I'll do yoga for maybe 45 minutes. I'll sit for maybe 30 minutes or so. And then in addition to that formal practice, which I know a lot of people listening are likely doing, they're doing their Muse meditation and mindfulness practice. In addition to that, I think it's just so key to have this integrated informal mindfulness practice throughout the day. I'm always working to find little cues in life that remind me to come back to the present moment, whether that's walking out the door or beginning a walk or even at the beginning of a meeting, right? I'm just constantly trying to find these opportunities to interrupt that ordinary sort of trance state of mind wandering that we slip into.
One of the things that I really appreciate is that Nate's practice in some respects is much more formal. And there was a way that, especially when you were first starting, I resented the practice where I was like, that just feels like free time. Like, how do you have an hour and 15 minutes or like an hour and a half or 2 hours where like, this is just free time. Don't you need to do some more childcare? Or shouldn't you be doing housework? And it's actually been incredibly powerful to shift where I now experience his mindfulness practice as a gift to our relationship. That space I experience, the compassion, all of that actually feels like a gift to me and a gift to our family. And I think about it, once upon a time, it felt like there were competing priorities where it was like, well, you're getting what you need for you. What about what I need for me? And now instead, it feels much more like, this is a gift to us.
Hello, listeners. This is Michael from the Psychologists of the Clock podcast. If you like what you hear on Untangle, let me extend a friendly invitation to check out our show as well. We are 4 experts in psychology that bring you cutting edge and science-based ideas to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health. You can find Psychologists of the Clock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and you can visit our website at offtheclockpsych.com.
Wow, this is huge. And I'm sure there's a lot of people on the call who identify with the sensation of potentially guilt doing their 45-minute long meditation practice in the morning and looking over at their couple, their partner, being like, is this okay that I'm doing this? But feeling the need to take the time. This is huge. So how did you make that shift to seeing it as generous? I'm asking on behalf of all of the meditators on the line who need to convince their spouses still.
Please feel free to pause the interview, go get your spouse, bring them back to have them listen. So I think the shift happened for me when I started recognizing all of the benefits that showed up for our family. So the first thing that I noticed was how much less reactivity Nate had than many of the partners that my friends were talking about. So I would say, such and such happened, and there was a deep breath, and then he could say, hey, I have a reveal. And they're like, that would never happen. And it really felt like that was only possible because there was space, because there was mindfulness. And then the second piece, I'm not sure if other people are teaching their kids, but Nate is also teaching our daughter how to meditate. And I am watching her show up in her own life when anxiety shows up and she's saying, I feel scared or I feel really nervous, that she has a toolkit that's available to her that's different. And that to me feels like a gift to me, to our family, to her, and to like her future life and future partners, that she has this whole ability to pause and get recentered and engage with life, not from all story, but from a spaciousness.
I would say one other thing, as the partner who meditates more, there's also some work to be done, which is there was definitely a time where I had this vision of Kaylee and I going on meditation retreats together and spending a week in silence. And wouldn't that be amazing? And what came from that desire or that fantasy was this like subtle pressure, like, don't you want to do this too? I mean, meditation's amazing. There's all this great science on the benefits for your brain, blah, blah, blah. And the more I did that, even on a subtle subconscious level, the more she reacted with that kind of like, you're wasting time energy. And then there was a point at which I just completely dropped it. Like not only explicitly, but implicitly, there was no part of me that needed Kaylee to sit with me on the cushion or go on a retreat. It was just gone. And I think that dissolved the polarity and allowed her to be more supportive. So all that's to say, if you are the meditator, you're the one who wakes up and does muse every morning, you have work to do too. And that is to just completely let go of your attachment to your spouse getting into meditation.
That totally undermined my next question, which was, how do you get your spouse to meditate in your system and your recommendation? Because I know it's something that I hear so often. I'm commonly asked, like, I wish my partner meditated. How do I get them to meditate? And my answer is typically like, leave your muse on their side of the bed, because that's one of the best gateway drugs to getting, like, you get the husband to meditate by getting him into the techie thing.
Right.
But what would you say within your system in general when there's something that you wished your partner would do?
It's certainly fair to make that ask. And if Kaylee says yes, great. If she says no, that's fine. But the power of dropping attachment to having your spouse meditate is that then I think they can make their own choice. And I think in many cases, they might see like, wow, there's something really interesting going on over there. I noticed some interesting changes happening in my partner. This is how we got our 9-year-old daughter really into meditation. I never really said anything about it. I just woke up and meditated and did my practice every single morning, and she would see me. And at a certain point, she's like, Dad, can we do that before I go to bed every night? And I'm like, yeah, totally. So now we do it every night, including like she'll do a sleepover with her grandparents and she'll tell me, yeah, so Dad, here's the meditation I did before bed. Like crazy, right? A 9-year-old who is devoted to her practice. But the way I got there with her anyway was not at all through like, you need to meditate, it's really good for you. It was more just doing my own practice, basically.
And I think another way to say the exact same thing, sort of as the partner who was less formally into it, is When there was pressure, I responded with resistance. And when there was just devotion, then there felt like an invitation.
It's beautiful. So can you leave us with some ways that people can engender the sense of devotion, generosity, care, if you maybe aren't totally feeling it right now?
Yeah, I might start with like a mindfulness piece, which would be just about as you go through your day to create a mini mindfulness practice out of noticing your thoughts about your partner. So becoming very aware of what the content of those thoughts is. As we've been talking about, there are all these kind of like habitual patterns that mostly fly under the radar of awareness that we don't even notice. So really become curious and interested in what those thoughts are. And what you may find, if you're like most people, is that there are a lot of thoughts about, I care more, I'm doing more, I'm trying harder. We call all of that fairness thinking. Or there are thoughts about resentment or issues you haven't talked about, things like that. So when you notice that, I would just say, for fun, as an experiment, see what happens when you just do a slight mindset shift to something like radical generosity or something like that reveal and request practice. So that would be my recommendation, is just this kind of like moment to moment integrated mindfulness practice of really getting curious about how you are perceiving your partner.
I would say there are three small things to do to get started and potentially one more involved practice to begin. So one is every day, look for a small way that you can contribute to your partner and do it. For extra credit, see if you cannot get caught. Two is appreciate your partner every day for something that if you weren't looking for it, you might feel entitled to or might be invisible. Three is reveal something about yourself. And it doesn't have to be an upset. This is just let your partner know you a little bit more by revealing something you think about or that you care about or you're excited about or you're nervous about. Get in the practice of revealing. So those are the three little is contribute, appreciate, reveal. And then the bigger one is to have a conversation with your partner about this chapter of your life. And if you could together decide how you want this chapter to be characterized, what are the values that underlie this chapter that sets you up together to feel on the same page about the ways that you're investing your time and your energy, what you're saying yes to and no to, and especially if presence, mindfulness, engagement, connection with each other is part of what you care about in this chapter, making that explicit then facilitates the support of the mindfulness practice that is already important to you.
That's fantastic. I'm going to go and leave a little note for my husband without him noticing.
Yay.
That makes me so happy.
Thank you very much for this beautiful conversation. And we should note as we go out, this has been a conversation about partners, but this conversation and the methodologies inside of it can also work effectively if you're not partnered. There are people in your life that you may have tension with, that you want to improve their relationship with, that you have to work with, that you are partnered as employee and employer with, where these kinds of tools and techniques can also be very helpful.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much for modeling for us, both in your difficulties and in your strategies, how to be great partners. Oh,
thank you for the conversation. Just what a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having us. Yeah.
That was Nate and Kaylee Klemp talking about theories from their new book, The 80-80 Marriage. If you're interested in learning more, you can go to 8080marriage.com and also find a free guide to epic date nights there. You can also follow them on Instagram, where they're hosting live Instagram mindfulness sessions at 8080marriage.com. And if you're looking for ways to improve your mindfulness and meditation, check out Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep. It gives you real-time feedback on your brain's activity during your meditation to help you become more aware of your own thoughts, to help you really learn when your mind is wandering, when you're thinking, and to really tease apart the process of your own mental state so that you can slow down the thoughts that you're having, understand what goes on inside your own mind, and be better able to come into the present moment, the here and now, and out of the stories. What Muse does is it tracks your brain during meditation. It gives you real-time feedback on your brain, your heart, your breath, and your body. And it's used by 500,000 people around the world to either start or enhance their meditation practice, including top athletes, top celebrities, clinicians, psychotherapists, psychiatrists, and more. You can find out more at choosemuse.com and use the discount code MUSESTRESSLESS. I'm wishing all of you a good day, a good relationship with those that you are close to proximally or those who are far from you but close to your heart. Wishing everybody the best. Until next week, when we have more Untangle.